Old Nurse Marshall prowled the camp, looking for sick prisoners to mark down for the buses. Sick women hid everywhere to escape, under the blocks, above the ceilings, behind the coal bins. Susanna invented a method of scraping the arms of women arriving from evacuated Auschwitz to cause their tattooed skin to appear infected, to hide their blue numbers. Everyone in the camp continued to hide the rabbits when roll call came. Some even traded numbers with us at great peril to themselves. Rumors flew. A prisoner nurse told Susanna that out at the former youth camp, the Jugendlager, not 10 minutes away from camp by truck, they were sending in older women restricted from work. The food was more filling and there was no roll call. Could it be true? Early that evening, I was given permission to go to the administration building and collect a package addressed to me. I left the block, happy I could finally walk without my crutch, but before long, Carol, a Jules from the Netherlands, caught me by the arm and pulled me into the shadows. My heart contracted. I was wary of most every Jules, for this was a new sort of character that emerged in the last year of the camp. Usually a German prisoner with a green or black triangle. A Jules would gather a man's sport coat, trousers, and even men's underpants from the booty piles, cut her hair in a masculine way, and swagger about the camp with a cigarette and a nasty attitude. Some would use a blade to carve an X, called a cow's cross, into the forehead of a girl they liked, marking her as theirs. The Jules were not all bad. I knew several nice ones, and it was often an advantage for a girl to go steady with the Jules, for it meant protection and food. But the objects of their affections were powerless to refuse, since the Jules always had connections in high places. They could starve a girl if she did not cooperate.
"They are doing another selection next door," Carol said. "Let's take a walk."
We walked away from the truck, taking the long way to the administration building. But I glanced back and saw Winkelmann and Nurse Marshall loading women onto one of the windowless black vans. A death transport. Neither of us had to say it. Anyone caught close to that hurricane could have been swept up for no good reason. As terrifying as some Jules were, Carol may have saved my life that day. Once the danger was over, I thanked her and continued on my way. I soon passed a long white canvas tent set up for a group of newly arrived prisoners in an open area just off Beauty Road. The camp had become so horribly crowded, and the transports kept coming from all countries. Zuren set up these tents right in the middle of camp. This one was so jam-packed with women and children that they were barely able to sit down under there. Many stood, trying to soothe their babies. "Kasia," someone called. I turned, surprised to hear my name. I didn't recognize her at first in the shadows under the tent, for her face was drawn and gaunt, and her short blonde hair gray with dust. "Nadia." She sat on an old suitcase, and the woman lay next to her with her head in Nadia's lap. Nadia stroked the woman's brow and murmured something to her. I watched for a second to make sure it was her, and then walked closer to the tent, just out of sight of the Aufsehen. "Nadia," I said. "Was this a hallucination?" She looked up as if her head was too heavy for her neck. "Kasia," she said, her breath a puff of white steam. How beautiful my name sounded when she said it. She put one hand out to stop me from coming closer. "We just saw a girl dragged away for talking to us, plus half of us have typhus. Be careful." I took a step toward her. What a happy day this was. How quickly could I get her to our block? "How long have you been here?" I asked quietly, so the guards would not hear. "We just arrived last night from Auschwitz. They said we are going to the youth camp. There is shelter there."
"When?" I don't know, she said, looking down at the woman in her lap. We're all so thirsty, and she needs a place to die in peace. Nadia, come quickly, I can hide you. I can't leave her. Someone else can tend to her. I stepped closer. You don't recognize her, do you? It's my mother, Kasia. I would never leave her. Mrs. Vatroba. How had they been caught? Come, I said. I knew I could hide them both. I know what you are thinking, my friend, but I am staying here with my matka. What can I get for you? Binz's guards began waving prisoners into the truck. Nothing, don't worry. We'll all be back in Lublin before you know it. Back with Pietrik. He will be happy to see you. She said this with a real smile, the old Nadia. It's you he loves, I said. Do you know how many times he asked me if you liked him? Hey, I left the book for you before I went, in the spot. You'll love chapter 5. I think the spot may be long gone, but we'll both check it together when we get back. Yes. Nadia gasped, one fist to her chest, her gaze fixed on my bad leg. One of the mismatched woolen men's socks I traded some of our toothpaste for had slid down to reveal it. By then healed, but withered and shrunken, missing whole tendons and bones, the skin shiny and taut. My God, Kasia, what happened to your leg? Water came to her eyes. To be crying for me while in her situation? This was a good friend. I'll tell you later, but now I can get you a drink. I have a bit of rainwater saved. Nadia smiled again. Always resourceful, Kasia. Matka would love that. I'll be right back, I said, and set off back to my block. My legs slowed my progress, and by the time I returned with water, the guards were loading the last of the prisoners into the open truck. They closed the back gate and banged twice on it, and the truck started off down Beauty Road. Nadia. It had been like medicine to see her. Would she be safe at the youth camp? I'd never heard of anyone going there from Ravensbrück before. I said the prayer that what I'd heard about the new camp there was true. Was God even listening to prayers from us? The truck continued down Beauty Road, and tears came to my eyes as I caught a glimpse of Nadia cradling her mother. I'll see you soon, Nadia, I called, running as best I could after the truck. She craned her neck above the crowd, smiled, and raised her hand. I watched the truck rumble off, the red taillights a blur. I wiped tears away. Were they really going to a safe place? It was hard to believe anything the Germans told us, but no matter what, the Danish girls in the front office said the Russians would be arriving soon to liberate the whole camp. At least Nadia and her mother would have shelter. Nadia was the strongest person I knew. I hurried onto the administration building to pick up my package, darkness descending on the camp. A family of rats, big as cats, walked across the road ahead of me. No longer afraid of people. I claimed my bundle at the postal window and glanced at the return address. Lublin Postal Center, Lublin, Poland, written in Papa's hand. I opened it as I walked back down the hallway, my wooden clogs echoing on the polished floor, and pulled out another spool of red thread. I never tired of seeing that. He'd sent two more since the first. Had Papa gotten word out to the world? If we were to die before the camp was liberated, at least everyone would know what happened, and the Germans would be punished for what they'd done. His packages had helped Susanna with her dysentery, but she then caught something else going block to block to doctor other prisoners. Headache, chills, fever. From the rash on her arms alone, we both knew what it was. Typhus. Nothing but liberation could help with that. I passed the desk of Brit Christiansen, a Danish girl I knew, one of many Scandinavian prisoners who worked the front office. She was tall with a short blonde bob and a pretty constellation of beige moles scattered down her cheek. I'd never even met a Danish person before the camp, and now found they were among my favorite people. Gentle, trustworthy, kind. "I have two things to tell you and we must be quick," Brit said in a soft voice. "One is an SS man, high up, came today inquiring about your mother."
"What?
Who?" "Not sure, but he was very tall."
"Lennart?
Here at Ravensbrück? Was Matka here too somewhere?" Brit pulled me closer.
"And also, they are hunting rabbits today."
Those words gave me goose flesh all over. "But it's almost dark."
"A night selection?"
"Vince is on the warpath. Surin is coming too. They doubled the liquor ration for the guards."
"We'll have to hide," I said.
"Could I get Susanna under the block? Or our niece could hide us with the Hungarian Jews again. The typhus ward?"
"They know you've been hiding under the block, Kasia.
We'll go up to the annex."
"They know that too, and there are new buses here."
"Buses." A jolt of fear shot through me. There was no time for hysterics. I hurried back to the block. An inky blackness settled in around me, for there was no moon that night. The floodlights above clicked on as I ran the best I could despite my bad leg, pushing women aside on the way to my block. "Just don't feel anything. If you are to live, you cannot feel." I knew as I entered the block that word of the hunt preceded me, for girls were crying and holding one another. I pushed through women from every country Hitler had plundered, the room a jumble of different languages. Russian, French, Hungarian, Polish. I found Susanna on her bunk, knees to her chest, shaking with chills. She barely lifted her head.
"Have you heard?" I said.
I sat next to her on the bunk and stroked her forehead. "They are coming for the rabbits. You need to get up, my darling." Susanna opened her eyes and then closed them.
"No, Kasia."
Anis pushed through the crowd, calling my name. "Get out now, Kasia," Anis said in her calm way. "They are coming. Beans and Sören and the women doctor. The Red Cross already took the Swedish girls, and French girls are being taken next, from the linen shop. I'll keep the back window open for you."
"In buses?" I said.
"Yes. Use the number 9284. It's safe. I could only get one."
I grabbed her wrist.
"Don't go, Anise. How do you know it's not a death transport?" How many times had we seen them trick women into buses? Some looked like ambulances with red crosses painted on the sides. We heard them drive around to the little painter's shack and cut their engines. After that, those prisoners' clothes would come back to the linen shop, smelling the sweet, unmistakable odor of gas. "It's the Swedish Red Cross, Kasia. The real thing, and you need to hurry."
"Girls, we have appel," said Marzenka, banging a pot with a wooden spoon.
Anise ran out with one last look back. I pulled Susanna by the hand. "We need to..."
"No, Kasia, you go."
She tried to lie back down on the bunk. "We need to get under the block," I said, as I pulled her up, held her around the waist, and guided her through the crowd toward the door, her weight light against me, like a dried branch.
Marzenka stood on a dining bench, hoarse from yelling above the din. "Please, Binz has given me her word. No harm will come to any of you."
That only increased the panic, and many ran for the door. But Binz and her dog appeared there ahead of her Aufseherinnen. Just outside the doorway stood Kommandant Sören and Dr. Oberhäuser, she with clipboard in hand. I was close enough to see light snow on the shoulders of Binz's gray cape. Her dog nipped at Susanna's leg, and we drew back.
Everyone out here now for appel, said Binz. Disobey orders and you will be shot.
Dr. Oberhäuser, at a block selection? We were trapped with no choice but to comply. No time to get to our hiding place. I pulled up my socks. Would the doctor recognize me? I supported Susanna as we all filed out onto Beauty Road in front of the block and stood at attention in the cool night air, the lights above shining bright. What if we ran? Even if we had good legs to run with, the dogs would finish us. Though it was cold, I felt hot all over. This was it. Why had I not been faster? Binz and Dr. Oberhäuser walked up and down our ranks and checked our numbers. Binz stopped in front of me, crop in hand.
Roll down your stockings, she said.
So this was how it was to end. I rolled down one sock. It revealed my good leg. Binz motioned to Dr. Oberhäuser. The doctor paused.
Well, doctor?
Binz said. I held my breath. The doctor seemed frozen in a dream as she stared at me. Was that hatred or pity? She motioned to my other leg.
The other one, Binz said.
I rolled my other sock down, over the smooth ridges of indentations where my muscles once were. The doctor must have recognized her handiwork, for she nodded a quick yes to Binz, and they moved on to Susanna. Susanna looked at me. Be strong, that look said. Next, we would go to the wall. Would I be able to be brave like the others and walk down Beauty Road, head held high? Dr. Oberhäuser seemed puzzled by Susanna at first, for her scars were not as obvious as others. Would she let Susanna go? Send me to the wall, I prayed. Let my sister live. Let one of us go home to Papa. The doctor nodded to Binz. Yes. Susanna took hold of my hand. We'd go to the shooting wall together as we'd always planned, there for each other until the end. Then something very strange happened. The lights went out. Not just the floodlights, but also every light in the camp. It was as if the hand of God had come down and drenched us in the kind of velvety black where you can't see a single thing. Girls called to one another. Zurin, Oberhäuser, and Binz barked orders in the darkness. The confused dogs growled. You would not have believed how loud it was in the camp with everyone on Beauty Road crying and calling out. Adelige, sit, said Binz, her tin training clicker chirping in the darkness. I grabbed Susanna by the waist and pulled her away from the group. Would the lights come back on any second? I felt my way along and brushed Dr. Oberhäuser in the darkness. A wave of the terrible perfume she wore washed over us. I stepped on Binz's foot and felt her arms windmill.
Verdammtes Arschloch, she said.
I headed for the linen shop, heart beating out of my chest, guessing the direction in the darkness, one arm around Susanna, the other outstretched in front of me like the cowcatcher in front of a train, bumping into people in the darkness. The fire from the crematorium in the distance was not bright enough to illuminate the camp, but I navigated by it. I practically dragged Susanna, her full weight against me. I knew we were in the right area when I saw a bus in front of the linen shop, the vehicle lit from within, the only light in the camp. As we drew closer to the shop building, I heard French girls talking. I felt for the back window and helped Susanna climb in, then followed her, pulling my bad leg in with great effort. It was warm in the room, and the crowd smelled good as I pushed through, a mix of perspiration and perfume. Susanna leaned against me. I can't go much farther. We are almost there, I said. You can rest soon. I saw Anissa's friend Claire in the glow of a flashlight. Kasha, she said. I grabbed her arm. Binz has us on her list. As soon as the lights come on, Susanna and I will be taken.
The lights won't come on tonight, Claire said. The Russian girls turned them off.
Zura flipped the switch at the transformer station once they heard Zoran was coming for the rabbits.
The whole electrical grid is down and they're not turning back on until morning.
How do you know these buses are really Red Cross?
Zoran has been stalling them, but they threatened to ram the gate. The girls in the office at Himmler himself authorized Count Bernadotte of Sweden to take us.
Elaborate hoaxes had been made up before to get girls to go peacefully, but it was our only chance.
Anise gave me a number, I said.
Make sure you move along, said Claire.
This is the last bus. Two have already loaded and are waiting at the gate to go.
I held Susanna and pushed through the crowd in the darkness. From the French I'd learned, I could tell the girls were all excited to be going home. As the last of them loaded, there were few left in the shop. Once I made it to the front of the line, I saw two men stood at the back of the bus checking numbers. One I did not know. The other was Fat Winkelmann, dressed in his long leather coat. The rear door of the bus was swung open wide to reveal French girls packed into the bus, standing, waiting. A blonde nurse dressed in a white uniform stood inside, helping people up the few steps. If this was a Nazi hoax, it was an elaborate one. But German guards often wore the uniforms of doctors and nurses in order to fool us. I breathed easier once I told Winkelmann the number Anise had given me, and I helped Susanna into the bus. When my turn came to step up into the bus, the nurse bent toward me. I set one foot on the wooden step stool. Was this really happening? Going home? To Lublin? To Papa? The nurse smiled and reached her hand to me, and I took it. Winkelmann placed his white stick across my chest.
Stop! Number?
The nurse clenched my hand tighter.
Their numbers have all been checked. We don't have time to argue. She spoke German, but with a Swedish accent.
We were going home. Winkelmann pushed me back with his stick, and the nurse released my hand.
My orders are French häftlings only. If this girl is French, I am Charles de Gaulle.
I am indeed French, I said in German. Did he see my leg shaking?
Yes, Winkelmann said. Say something in your native tongue, French girl.
Without hesitating, I said in the most forceful French I could, "This dryer is too hot. Can you cut a little more off the sides? May I have a permanent wave, please, with medium curl and extra end papers? And use the boar bristle brush, for it seems to help with my dandruff."
Winkelmann looked at the other man.
"She's a Pole for sure," he said. "Just get on the bus," the other man said and waved me on.
"We need to move," said the nurse, pulling me up to join Susanna. "Come in quickly." As the nurse began to shut the doors, a prisoner ran to the bus with a bundle of clothes.
"Wait, your baggage," she called out,
and handed the package up.
"That's mine," said sweet Pierrot Poirot, a friend of Anise's, from the front of the bus.
The girls passed the bundle down to her, and her friends drew near. The bus jerked forward, and we started on our way toward the open gates. Just a short way to freedom.
Please, let this be a real hospital bus.
The white pole at the guard station lifted. The bus driver gunned the gas, and we left the gates behind. Why did I not feel the joy of liberation? We made our way down the road along the lake, and Pianot opened her bundle.
My God! It is Guy, said Claire to me.
Pianot opened the blanket to show a tiny newborn, pink and healthy, with a head of dark hair. He was born 2 days ago. Thank God he didn't cry. Smart boy. We rumbled down the road, the bus lights showing the way, illuminating the backs of our escorts.
three German soldiers on motorcycles. How strange to be on a bus once again. How I had missed the pleasing pull of it, gears shifting, then hesitating, gliding and pushing on, going somewhere. The road went from cobblestones to smooth paving made flat by the road crew's concrete roller. What a fine job you did, ladies, I thought. If only you could feel the smoothness of it. A tea kettle cried somewhere close, already at the boil. A bomb. The earth shook, rocking the bus, and the lake lit up like a camera flash. "It's the Allies bombing," the nurse said. "They must think we are a German caravan." The driver cut the lights, the engine too, as the Germans left us and buzzed back to camp, their taillights growing smaller and smaller in the darkness. The tea kettle whined again, and we cried out as the ridge above us split and our faces lit up, as if around a campfire. At least the impact felt like something, like we were alive, and sent us to the rubber floor. I held my sister to me, bone on bone, and we fell against the others. Did she breathe? Did I? I pressed her to my chest, warm against me. Soon the bus engine came alive, and we lurched on towards Sweden, our two hearts one.
Chapter 26. Hertha, 1945. By April of 1945, Germany had lost the war, though the news media would not admit this. They clung to their fairy tale world until the end. I knew the war was lost from listening to foreign broadcasts in my quarters. According to the BBC, the Western Allies had pushed past the Rhine, and German casualties soared. Zuren said it was only a matter of time before Germany reclaimed Paris, but I knew we were defeated. On April 18th, we heard that American tanks rolled into my hometown of Düsseldorf and easily captured the city. The British and Americans were headed full speed toward Berlin. One afternoon, I left camp and stole along the lakeshore, my steps muffled by humps of moss, suitcase handles slippery in my hand. The lake was angry, and white caps whipped across it. Was it stirred by the breeze, or by those whose ashes were buried there, settled into silt? How could I be blamed? I had only taken the job of camp doctor out of necessity. It was too late for the lost to raise their bony fingers and give testament against me now. As I neared Fürstenberg, I met a sea of German men, women, and children walking, some with luggage, some with only the clothes on their backs. Half of Fürstenberg's civilians had headed south months before, and it seemed the other half was evacuating that day to escape the Red Army. From their posture alone, one read the humiliation of defeat. I joined that great Autobahn of the displaced and was swept up in the crowd, half numb. It was hard to believe it was all over, that I was running away. The shame of it was near debilitating. "Where are you going?" I asked a German man in a tweed overcoat and mustard yellow hat. He carried a birdcage strapped to his back. The bird swayed, perched on its little wooden trapeze as the man walked. "We are taking side roads to avoid Berlin, then south to Munich. There are American troops advancing from the west, Russians from the east." I joined a group headed for Düsseldorf, and our passage on foot was long and unremarkable. We avoided main routes and followed wooded trails and field tracks, slept in abandoned cars, eating anything we could find to stay alive. I imagined how happy Mutti would be to see me. She had been living with a man named Günther in a nice apartment upstairs from our old place, and I'd stayed with them one holiday break. He was a nice enough magazine salesman. Rich, too, by the looks of the apartment. I imagined the fried onions and mashed potatoes with applesauce she would make in that kitchen when I got home. It was drizzling when I reached Düsseldorf, and I had to be careful to keep a low profile since there were American soldiers everywhere. Not that I was high on the authorities' list of suspects. Did they even care about me? They had bigger fish to fry. The streets of Düsseldorf were littered with abandoned suitcases and horse and human corpses. I walked by the Düsseldorf train terminus, bombed to rubble. As I neared Mutti's building, I passed a looted wagon tipped on its side as two elderly women tried to strip off its wheels. Along the street, people came and went, some with all their worldly possessions. I tried to blend in with them, to look like just another displaced person. Once I made it to Mutti's doorstep, I was happy to see the apartment building not only still standing, but in perfect order. All I could think of was her bathtub and a hot meal. The smell of fried onions hung in the lobby. Some lucky person had squirreled away some food. I made it to the third floor and rang Günther's apartment bell.
"Who's there?" came a voice from behind the closed door.
"Günther." "It is Hertha." He hesitated. What was that buzzing sound in my head? Was it due to dehydration?
"Is my mother there?"
I called through the door. The lock clicked, and the door swung open.
"Quickly," Günther said. "Come in."
He grabbed me by the arm, pulled me inside, and relocked the door. The apartment was still well furnished, with thick carpets and chairs upholstered in velvet. Someone had removed a portrait of the Führer from the wall, exposing a rectangle of brighter wallpaper behind.
That was fast.
"Two looters tried to break the door down this morning. It's anarchy out there."
"Really, Günther?"
"Everyone steals from everyone now. Goods belong to those who can hold on to them."
"I'm starving," I said.
"Everyone is starving, Hertha."
"They were still cooking food at the camp."
"That's not all you and your friends were doing there."
"The truth is getting out, you know."
I walked to the radio. "There must be rations. They will broadcast..."
"No rations, Hertha. No broadcasts. Women are prostituting themselves for a spoonful of sugar."
Günther did not appear to have missed many meals. He'd lost a bit of weight, but his skin was still taut.
"Just a slight craping at the neck."
How had he managed to stay out of military service? Things were not adding up, and the buzzing sound in my head grew louder. "I'm in need of a bath," I said. Günther lit a cigarette. How was he getting cigarettes?
"You can't stay here. They know what you've done, Hertha."
"Where is Mutti?"
"She had to go down to the station. They came looking for you."
"Me? What for?" I didn't have to ask who.
"Crimes against humanity," they said.
How could they be on my trail so quickly?
"You are putting your mother at risk, Hertha, just being here. Take your bath, but you need to find other..."
"My mother may feel differently," I said.
"Take a bath, and then we'll talk."
I set my suitcase on the sofa. "I may need Mutti's help with some matters." He tapped cigarette ash into the ashtray.
"Money matters?"
"Among other things. Legal fees, maybe."
"Oh, really? If anything should happen to you, the state pays the fees."
"Happen?" Günther strolled to the hall closet and came back with a towel. Take your bath while we still have hot water. We'll talk later. I dropped my things in the guest room and ran the bath, one ear to the lavatory door, half expecting Günther to call the authorities. There was sure to be some sort of allied military hierarchy set up. Günther would never turn me in, I assured myself. Mutti would be livid. But Günther had never been a real patriot, and the new power shift made almost everyone suspect. I locked the bathroom door and took my time running the water extra hot. I slipped into the tub, sliding down the enameled cast iron into that glorious burning sea. I felt every muscle slacken there in the hot water. Where was Fritz? I would ask for my old job back at the skin clinic, if it was still standing, not under a pile of stones. I rehearsed my talk with Mutti as I soaped my legs, feet black with dirt from the walk. She would support me, no matter what Günther said. So what, she would say when I told her about the camp. You were doing your job, Hertha. Where was she? Probably out doing her best to find some bread. I closed my eyes and recalled Mutti's breakfasts. Hot rolls and fresh butter. Her coffee. Were those footsteps in the living room? Mutti? I called. Günther? A rap at the bathroom door. Hertha Oberhäuser? Came the voice through the door. The speaker had a British accent. Shit! Goddamn Günther, I had known he was not to be trusted. How much had they paid him to turn me in? I'm coming, I said. I lost control of my limbs there in the tub. Could I make it out the window? Something hard hit the door, and it cracked open. I may have screamed as I reached for the towel. A British officer entered the bathroom, and I sat back in the tub, the diminishing soap bubbles my only protection. Hertha Oberhäuser? He asked. I tried to cover myself. No? I hereby place you under arrest for war crimes against humanity. I'm not she, I said, in shock, like an imbecile. How could Günther do this to me? Mutti would be furious. I have done nothing. Step out of the tub, Fräulein, said the man. Another British agent came to the bathroom with a canvas raincoat in hand. I motioned for the two to turn their backs. I will leave for a moment, said the first agent, red-faced. He handed me a towel, averting his eyes. Wrap yourself in this. I took the towel, and he left, pulling the door closed. I hoisted myself out of the tub. Goddamn Günther, I thought as I stepped to the medicine cabinet. I found his razor blades and slid back into the tub, the water cooling. Fräulein, called the first man from outside the door. Just a moment, I said as I pulled a blade from the pack. I felt for the radial artery and found it easily, since my heart was pumping hard. I drew the blade down my wrist, deep into the artery, and watched it open like a peach. The water grew pink, and I lay back in it as it cooled, lightheaded. Would Mutti cry when she saw what I'd done? At least I'd done it in the tub. Cleanup would be easy. Before I could get to the other wrist, the agent came back in. Christ! He said when he saw me, the water squid inked with red by then. Teddy! He called to someone somewhere. Christ! He said again. After a great deal of shouting in English, they pulled me from the tub. So much for modesty. I was losing consciousness, not about to tell them how to treat me, but noted with satisfaction they were doing just fine without me, for some reason elevating my legs. A sure way to make me bleed out. My feet were still filthy black, in each toenail a crescent of dirt. I lost consciousness, but regained it as they carried me out on a stretcher, my wrist nicely bandaged. Someone knew what he was doing. There was a doctor among them? Was he surprised a German doctor had done such a poor job? "Why did you turn me in?" I tried to say to Günther as the British agents carried me down the stairs to the street. They started to load me into an ambulance. I saw Günther watching from a window above, his face impassive. More faces came to windows. Old men, women, they brushed aside curtains and peered down. Just curious Germans. A girl with yellow braids came to the window, and her mother pushed her away and drew the shade. "She's only curious," I said. "What?" said an Englishman. "She's in shock," said another. "Unter Schock?" "Incomplete diagnosis, English doctor." "Hypovolemic shock, rapid breathing, general weakness, cool, clammy skin." More faces came to the windows. A full house. Something wet drifted down to my face. Was that rain? I hoped no one would mistake it for tears.
Part 2. Chapter 27. Caroline. April 1945. Mother, waylaid with the grip, sent me off to Paris alone. She was terribly worried, of course, since the Allies may have helped liberate France, but the war was far from over. How many rogue U-boats were still out there in the Atlantic? I would not be deterred, however, on the eve of seeing Paul again after 5 long years. I'd taken a bit more silver to Mr. Snyder in order to make the trip. The pedophore tongs, butter knives, a few dinner forks. I docked at La Rochelle, north of Bordeaux, on April 12, 1945. When we disembarked, the first mate announced that President Roosevelt had died at his home in Warm Springs, Georgia, and a collective groan went up from all of us gathered there. The president died before he got to see the Germans surrender in France. He never knew Hitler took his own life. Roger had arranged for a car and driver to get me up to Paris, and I took in devastated France from the back seat. It's one thing to read of war in newspapers and chart the action with pins, but it was quite another to see France ripped asunder. It had been more than 7 months since the Allied forces helped liberate Paris, but the destruction was still fresh. Entire blocks were decimated, buildings imploded, and the walls of many apartment buildings had been sheared off, showing a cross-section of still furnished rooms. Our drive was repeatedly detoured, since black craters and tank-sized sections of macadam blown off the roads were still not repaired. South of Paris, not a bridge over the Seine was left standing. Yet even with all the devastation, it was spring, and the city was still lovely rising from the ruins. The Arc de Triomphe untouched, 5 flags draped under the arch. Once in Paris, I borrowed our caretaker's old Peugeot, which was powered by an improvised wood-burning stove fixed to the back. A wartime lack of gasoline had led to widespread use of these homemade gasogenes, wood gasification units mounted on the backs of buses, taxicabs, and private cars. It was quite a sight to see these vehicles on the streets, each with its own combustion tank fixed to the rear. Drivers stopped at filling stations to stoke the stove with firewood, not to get gasoline. Driving such a car in Paris was challenging, for the streets were choked with bicycles and they owned the roads. As a result, the metro was more popular than ever. Even the wealthiest counts were seen in its depths. I arrived at the crossroads of the Boulevard Raspail and Rue de Sèvres that night and choked back a sob at the sight of the Hôtel Lutetia, still there. Freed from her Nazi occupiers, the towering Belle Époque Hotel stood fearless,
her name in lights above, the tricolor flying again. I pushed through the hotel entrance, past a tangle of the mothers, husbands, wives, and girlfriends of deportees, and who waved pictures of the missing and called out their names, hoping for news. The lobby, its black-and-white tiled floor strewn with trampled notices and lilac sprigs, was packed with journalists, Red Cross workers, and government officials, all jockeying for position at the front desk. A frail woman in black, her back hunched, seized my arm as I squeezed through the crowd. "Have you seen this man?" she said, as she thrust a photograph of a white-haired man in my face. "No, I'm so sorry," I said. In the dining room, groups of dazed survivors, still in their striped camp uniforms, sat at tables under the crystal chandeliers, as waitresses brought them the best of everything. Veal, champagne, cheese, and fresh bread, from the provisions the Nazis left behind. Many deportees sat and stared at the food, unable to eat. Some, who ate more than a few bites, headed for the lavatory. Searchers elbowed their way into the great gallery, to walls plastered with notices and photos of missing loved ones, many inked with black X's, meaning those deportees would never return. That is where I found it. Paul Rodier, Suite 515. I sprinted to the elevator, but found it so choked with people the door would not close, and ran on to the stairs. On the way, I passed men, skin stretched taut over their skulls, wandering the back halls, their camp uniforms hanging from them. What would Paul look like? I prepared myself to find him in that state or worse. I didn't care, as long as I could be with him every day. I'd pay whatever it took to get him well. I passed guest rooms turned hospital wards, fitted with extra cots, the doors propped open. 5'11", 5'13". In the hallway, two gendarmes chatted with a pretty nurse. Love was back, now that the war was over. I found the spacious fifth-floor suite, tall windows open to the city below, the Eiffel Tower in the distance. A lovely French Louis XVI Bouvier cane bed against one wall. The royal treatment for the famous Monsieur Rodier. From the doorway, I watched Paul as he sat in an overstuffed chair, playing cards with three other men, the curtains on the windows stirring in the gentle breeze. Paul was dressed in a plain button-front shirt, and a nurse sat behind him, one arm across the back of his chair, the other hand on his pulse. It was so strange to see him in that lovely suite with the damask drapes and fine wool carpets. I stepped closer and looked over Paul's shoulder at his cards. "I wouldn't bet the farm on that hand," I said. Paul turned his head and smiled. To my relief, he looked fine. Gaunt, and his head was newly shaved. But he was alive, awash in that white cotton shirt. I couldn't wait to get him home to his own bed. I would spend every penny I had on doctors if I had to.
"Have you brought no money for me to bet with?" Paul asked. "No Russian cigarettes? Come here and kiss me."
I stepped around the chair and saw, with a jolt, Paul's legs extended out from under the bottom of his shirt. Long and thin, knobbed at the joints like the legs of a cricket.
"I won't break, you know. And don't believe a word the doctor says. If my winnings are any indication, I'm fine."
"I don't know where to start," I said as I knelt by the side of his chair, afraid to touch him. Was it painful to be so thin? A young doctor approached us, his orange hair piled atop his head like frizzled saffron.
"You are a relative?" the doctor asked. "She's a friend,"
Paul said.
Miss Faraday from New York.
The doctor looked me over, his eyes red-rimmed. Had it been days since he'd slept?
Can you walk with me, please?
The doctor said. I sensed a tenuous criticism, as if he disapproved of me somehow.
I am Dr. Philippe Bedreau, he said once we stood in the hallway. I have been treating Paul for a few weeks now. He made an excellent recovery from typhus, due in part to chloramphenicol, a new drug. Then he took an inexplicable turn for the worse. Pneumonia.
Pneumonia? My breath caught in my throat. Like father. Pneumonie. So much prettier in French, but just as deadly. Something mother still referred to as lung fever.
He recovered, but is by no means out of the woods. Are you staying in the city?
At my mother's apartment, close by. Does Paul know about his wife's death?
Yes. It was a great shock, and he refuses to speak of it. Right now he needs to sleep. At some point he'll need aggressive physical therapy due to muscular atrophy.
Will he recover completely? I asked.
Too early to tell, mademoiselle. We are dealing with a ruined body here. He has lost almost half his overall body weight.
Mentally, he seems fine, I said. Playing poker.
He is an actor. Of course he puts up a good front. But we must be very careful. His heart and lungs have been through a great trauma.
So are you guessing 2 weeks? 3?
He may not wake up tomorrow as it is. You must let him recover.
I am sorry, doctor.
A young man was set to go home last week. Vital signs good. And he died of cardiac failure the morning he was to leave. Who knows when we can consider these patients cured?
I'm just eager to...
He must not exert himself in any way. No cooking, extended walks, and certainly no... well...
What, doctor?
Certainly no extracurricular activities.
I beg your pardon.
Complete bed rest.
With Paul alone in the bed, he wanted to say. After the doctor left, I sat at Paul's bedside, watching his chest rise and fall under the blanket.
Don't leave, Paul said.
I smoothed the back of my hand across his cheek. Never, I said. I saw Paul every day and decamped to Mother's apartment each night. I was relieved the old place had survived the war relatively unscathed, thanks to our caretaker's wife, Madame Solange. The apartment was surprisingly untouched. Not a crack in the floor-to-ceiling casement windows or the hornbeam parquet floors, though fine white powder covered every surface. The silver-topped jars on my mahogany vanity table, now 2 inches deep in silty dust. The carriage clock in Father's study had stopped at 9:25, and there'd been a leak in Mother's bedroom. A section of damask wallpaper curled down off the wall there like a stained sow's ear. Paul slept for much of those first 2 weeks, but soon asked to go home to the house he and Rena had shared in Rouen. Dr. Bedreau reluctantly agreed, with additional vague references to a ban on lovemaking that made Paul smile. Dr. Bedreau insisted a doctor had to visit Paul every day, for Rena's house was several miles outside of Paris, with limited access to hospital care. I agreed, happy to pay whatever it took to make Paul happy, and with the help of 3 strong nurses, we managed to get him into the front seat of the Peugeot. On the road to Rouen, fresh evidence of combat was everywhere, and many buildings were nothing more than facades. The imposing Rouen Cathedral, made famous by Monet's paintings, was one of the few buildings left intact. Paul directed me to a bunker-like house on a side street in Rouen. Not at all what I'd expected. I helped Paul up the front walk and considered the house, which resembled a military pillbox, cold and standoffish. It was designed in the Bauhaus style, another abhorrent thing Germany had foisted on France. Would the neighbors come out to greet him? Would they think me an interloper? After all, Rena had grown up in the house, and she and Paul had lived there together. Did they have friends? Couples on the street who missed her? Paul and I walked into the front hallway and inched our way across the living room. It was a dark house, but the rooms were done in the bright prints of Provence. I considered asking Paul if we could live at Mother's apartment, with its lovely morning light and pastel boiseried walls, filled with the pieces Mother and I had found at the Marché aux Puces and other antiquaires. My Louis XVI commode, the fin de siècle metal garden table in the kitchen. Mother had gone a bit toile crazy, but it was nicely done. All it needed was a good dusting. I helped Paul up the stairs and past a snug little room with yellow fabric-upholstered walls and onto the master bedroom, where Paul and Rena once slept. The bed was small for a man as tall as Paul, and wore a white matelassé bed cover and blue-and-white ticking pillows. I pulled a chair next to Paul's bed and watched him sleep well into the night. Eventually, I moved to the padded window seat and slept for a bit. Before dawn, Paul spoke.
Rena.
No, Paul, it's Caroline.
Caroline, I am so cold.
I brought my blanket to the bed and smoothed it over him.
I thought I was in the hospital, he said.
No, you're home, dear. He was back asleep before I finished the sentence. It was strange to cook in Rena's kitchen, the copper pot still burnished bright, her drawers filled with pressed cotton napkins folded in neat stacks. There was little food to cook, for all over France, meat and vegetables were hard to come by. At first, I improvised. With a ration card, a lucky sort could hunt down some potatoes and bread, perhaps some anemic carrots, but most of the country existed on thin soups and toast. Then I raided Mother's pantry at her apartment and struck gold. Molasses, oatmeal, and tea bags. Eventually, I found one could buy anything for a price on the black market. Each day, I served Paul an old family remedy my great-grandmother Wolsey gave her soldier patients at Gettysburg. One egg and soda water beaten into a glass of wine. Several other Wolsey remedies were on the menu as well, including beef tea, milk punch, and rice with molasses. I told Paul they were old New England favorites from my distaff side. Thanks to them, he grew stronger every day. Would it help to talk about the camp? I asked one night.
I can't talk about it, Caroline. You have good intentions.
You have to at least try, Paul. Maybe start with the night you left here. Baby steps. He was quiet for a long moment.
They came for me with no warning, thinking I might be good for their cause. Rena was sick in bed with the flu. Took me to headquarters and told me very nicely they wanted me to film some things. Propaganda, of course, but I wouldn't do it. They kept me in Paris for a while and then sent me to Drancy. I guess they came back later to get Rena and her father. That was the beginning of the roundups, taking the Jews.
How did they know Rena was here?
They knew everything. Maybe from the visa application. I don't know. Drancy was horrible, Caroline. They took the